Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. Today we're going to be talking about the sixth episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And today's topic is 20 in 20. So in 20 minutes, I'm going to discuss 20 pharmacology cases. And I'm going to try to integrate a lot of like other pharmacology, some pathology, some physiology and stuff like that. And I can imagine the blood pressures of all the fourth year medical students today. I can imagine it must be really low with expectations for match day tomorrow. Have a fun Thursday before you find out where you're going for the next, anywhere from 3 to 7 or 8 years. Okay, so let's go ahead and begin. So the first case describes gynecomastia in a patient being treated for peptic ulcer disease. So gynecomastia in a patient being treated for peptic ulcer disease. Hopefully you're thinking about cimetidine. Okay, cimetidine is a H2 receptor antagonist. Okay, it's used to treat peptic ulcer disease. Remember, by blocking those H2 receptors, you're preventing the enterochromaffin-like cell-mediated stimulation of parietal cells, right, through histamine H2 receptors that are GS-coupled. So when you inhibit that stimulation, you have less cyclic AMP in the parietal cell, and you secrete less acid, okay? So this drug, it so happens that it has androgen receptor blocking activity. So by blocking androgen receptors, it can cause a gynecomastia because it sort of tilts you towards having, like your estrogen to testosterone ratio. It tilts you towards having like more estrogenic effects. Okay. Remember that cimetidine is also an inhibitor of cytochrome P450. Good. Next case. Seizures in a patient with a history of severe pruritus between the finger webs, right? So if you see pruritus between the finger webs, I really hope you're thinking about scabies. Okay, remember scabies is caused by Sarcoptes scabii. Okay, so the drugs you could use, the drug you should use in your patients is permethrin. Okay, you can use permethrin, but a second line agent is a drug known as lindane. Okay, it so happens that lindane has it blocks GABA receptors. So by blocking GABA receptors, think about it, you're having a net glutamatergic effect because GABA that normally calms you down no longer has that effect because you're blocking the receptors. So you could potentially get seizures with lindane. Okay, remember this is sort of similar to the way isoniazid also causes neurotoxicity and seizures because isoniazid depletes your vitamin B6, and vitamin B6 or pyridoxal phosphate is a cofactor for glutamate decarboxylase, which helps you convert glutamate to GABA. Okay, so you have a net increase in glutamate and you can run into a lot of trouble. Also remember that glutamate decarboxylase is the enzyme that you make autoantibodies against in type 1 diabetes. Okay, good. Next case. What is the preventive measure that could have been taken in a patient presenting with an EF of 25% 3 months after chemotherapeutic treatment of a lymphoma? Well, hopefully you're thinking about dilated cardiomyopathy, okay, classically with your anthracyclines like Doxo and Donorubicin, okay. So remember, these drugs are intercalating agents, so they sort of stick themselves between DNA. So you begin to form all these like nasty crosslinks and stuff like that. It so happens that these anthracyclines are heavily bound by Doxo, iron, and that complex can cause the formation of a lot of superoxide radicals that can cause myocardial cell damage. Okay, so you can prevent that by giving an iron chelator like dextroxazine. Okay, giving an iron chelator like dextroxazine. Remember, your anthracyclines cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy. Contrast that with trastuzumab that causes a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay, next case, prevention of secondary hemochromatosis in a patient with a history of beta thal major, right? So patients with a history of beta thal major, they need to keep getting regular blood transfusions, right? So that can cause a lot of iron loading. So you can treat that by giving a drug that's an iron chelator, okay? Like deferoxamine, okay, or deferasirox, okay? Remember, those things have FE in their names. I guess deferasirox also has a FE in its name. So that helps you remember that those are iron chelators. Okay, next case, rapidly progressive neurological deficits, okay, over weeks, and somnolence in a patient who was recently started on a drug. Okay, oligoclonal bands have previously been found with CSF studies in this patient? Well, the thing I'm really hoping you're thinking about here is a patient that has multiple sclerosis, okay? Remember the association with oligoclonal bands in the CSF, okay? Remember, you can see all these enhancing lesions on MRI that are separated by space and time. Okay, so the drug I'm talking about here is natalizumab. Natalizumab is a monoclonal antibody against alpha-4 integrin, and it has a strong association with the reactivation of the JC virus, which can present as a progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. Okay, and while we're on the topic of integrins, remember that an integrin deficiency is also associated with like the leukocyte adhesion deficiency, where they give you a question about a neonate that has like delayed separation of the umbilical cord. Okay, now next case, severe hypotension and adrenal hemorrhage in a patient lost to follow-up after receiving a 2-year subscription of some drug. Flow cytometry of a blood sample from this patient revealed an absence of GPI anchors. Okay, revealed an absence of GPI anchors, right? So if a patient has some disorder where they have no GPI anchors on flow cytometry, I'm really hoping you're thinking of a PIGA gene mutation. Okay, that's a paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Okay, so because those people don't have like CD55 and CD59, complement comes and explodes their red cells. Okay, it's a kind of intravascular hemolysis, and in that case, that person will basically have some kind of hemolytic anemia, right? So it's classically a young male that presents with hematuria in the mornings because complement is activated more often, at least at an increased level at night. Okay, so remember, the treatment of PNH is with eculizumab. It's a monoclonal antibody against C5. Okay, so by basically creating a functional C5 deficiency, this person has an increased risk of Neisseria infections. Okay, and remember, Neisseria meningitis, for example, can cause Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, which is where you have adrenal hemorrhage. Okay, so that's what I'm presenting with this case. Case number 7, management of a patient who presents with a white count of 52,000. Okay, leukocyte alkaline phosphatase is decreased. Well, hopefully you're thinking about CML, okay, chronic myeloid leukemia. Remember your association with the 922 translocation, where you create the BCR-ABL tyrosine kinase. Okay, it's a fusion protein. That protein is upregulated in people that have CML. And the way you manage CML is by giving a drug known as imatinib. Okay, basically, I'll just give you a trick right now. Any drug that ends in nib is a tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Okay, so you treat this condition with imatinib. And the leukocyte alkaline phosphatase, I say it's low. That helps you differentiate CML from a leukomoid reaction where the leukocyte alkaline phosphatase is high. Remember that imatinib is also used to treat GI stromal tumors, okay, because it also inhibits the c-kit tyrosine kinase receptor. Next case, case number 8. Patient with a history of an apical core lesion detected in abdominal CT fails to respond to therapy with an inhibitor of the epidermal growth factor receptor. Okay, so apical core lesion, abdominal CT, you're thinking of colon cancer, right? So colon cancer, many colon cancers, for some bizarre reason, overexpress the epidermal growth factor receptor. Okay, so you could potentially treat a colon cancer by giving a monoclonal against the EGFR receptor. Okay, so you can give a drug like cetuximab. Okay, but the thing is, it so happens that KRAS falls downstream of the epidermal growth factor receptor. So if you're taking an EGFR inhibitor and you're not recording any kind of effect, think about some kind of activating mutation in KRAS. Okay, and to sort of tie some things together for you, your friends at the MBME want you to know the adenoma carcinoma sequence with colon cancer, right? So like you can remember that with the mnemonic AK53, okay? So you start with an APC gene mutation, and then you progress to a KRAS mutation. Okay, remember, KRAS is downstream of EGFR. And then if you get a P53 mutation, you get a full-blown colon carcinoma, okay? So next case, food drop in a patient recently placed on some kind of chemotherapeutic regimen, right? So I really hope you're thinking of peripheral neuropathy, okay? If you, many cancer drugs can cause peripheral neuropathy, but classically on board exams, the drug you want to think about is vincristine, okay? Vincristine. Remember, vincristine is a vinca alkaloid, okay? So it binds to tubulin and essentially prevents the polymerization of microtubules. Okay, and remember microtubules, right? You need them for proper neuronal function. If you want to get things to the synapse with those molecular models, you need microtubules to make that happen. So that potentially explains the peripheral neuropathy you get with the vinca alkaloids. And remember that your vinca alkaloids sort of work like colchicine. Okay, colchicine also works by preventing the formation of the polymerization of microtubules. Okay, and I hope if you hear the words foot drop, you're thinking of a common peroneal nerve palsy. Okay, just an anatomy tie in there. Okay. Case number 10, reduced DLCO and AST-ALT elevations in a patient with a history of a snowstorm appearance detected on a pelvic ultrasound, right? So snowstorm appearance, pelvic ultrasound makes you think about an invasive mole, okay? And remember, invasive, hydatidiform moles, they can progress and become invasive, I guess. One way you can treat hydatidiform moles, besides suction curettage, actually, you should do a suction curettage, but let's assume it becomes invasive and whatnot. You can treat with methotrexate, okay? Remember, methotrexate is a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor. It has a very strong association with pulmonary fibrosis, right? So you can get a restrictive lung disease picture. That's why the DLCO is reduced, and methotrexate is also hepatotoxic, okay? And remember, you shouldn't give methotrexate to a pregnant woman so you don't give her kid a neurotube defect. Okay, next case. Flushing and myoclonus in a patient who recently started oral antibiotic therapy against a gram-positive, catalase-positive, and coagulase-positive organism. This patient has a history of generalized anxiety disorder, right? So basically, I'm describing Staph aureus, okay? So let's assume this person has MRSA, okay? One oral drug you could use to treat MRSA is linezolid, okay? Remember, linezolid inhibits initiation, okay? It binds to the 50S contribution to the P site of the ribosome, okay? Linezolid, it so happens, has some weak monoaminooxidase inhibitor activity, okay? So if a person has a history of generalized anxiety disorder for which the drug of choice, the SSRIs, you could potentially imagine a person getting a serotonin syndrome, okay? And please don't forget that you treat serotonin syndrome with like cyproheptadine, which is it's a H1 blocker that also has a serotonin receptor blocking activity. Okay, so next case, severe vomiting and flushing in a chronic alcoholic with a recent treatment for C. diff colitis. Okay, so C. diff colitis, remember, it's your post-antibiotic diarrhea. Okay, classically, it's a watery diarrhea. And the first line drug for treating C. diff colitis is metronidazole. Metronidazole has the disulfiram side effect. Okay, so it inhibits acetaldehyde dehydrogenase, so you can have a buildup of acetaldehyde and you can begin to run into a lot of trouble if you're taking booze on the side. Okay, so that's your disulfiram effect. So the thing you want to think about with your disulfiram effect, think about that with metronidazole. Remember, this drug also causes a metallic taste in the mouth. Okay, and remember the other things you could use to treat C. diff colitis, right? So you could use vancomycin, oral vancomycin. Okay, you could use fidaxomicin. It's a macrolide that also works as an RNA polymerase inhibitor. And I guess your last line could also be a fecal transplant. Okay, next case. Hemoglobin of 5, white count of 500, and platelet count of 20,000, right? So these are all abnormal in a patient treated for a monospot negative mononucleosis-like syndrome, okay? Monospot negative mononucleosis-like syndrome, right? So this patient has CMV, okay? Remember the association with owl's eye inclusions, okay, on microscopy. And the way you treat CMV is with ganciclovir, okay? So ganciclovir inhibits DNA polymerase, but it needs to be activated by a UL97 kinase, okay? So it's activated by UL97 kinase, it's incorporated into the genome, and then it causes a chain termination, okay? So ganciclovir has a strong association with bone marrow suppression, okay? That's why this patient has this presentation, okay? And remember that CMV, if you have, has many other things it causes, right? So it can cause like retinitis in a HIV patient or colitis in a patient with like a recent history of transplant, and it can also cause like linear ulcers, right? Esophagitis in a patient with a history of HIV. Okay, next case. Severe epigastric pain radiating to the back in a patient recently started on some kind of pharmacotherapy. This patient has a history of inconsistent condom use. So history of inconsistent condom use should make you think about HIV. Okay. One of the drug classes for the treatment of HIV or NRTIs includes drugs like stavudine and didanosine. Okay. These drugs have a very strong association with pancreatitis. Okay. In fact, that's probably the biggest side effect you want to remember with those medications. Okay. Next case, severe diarrhea, full body rash and abdominal pain in a patient who was recently started on pharmacologic management for HIV. This patient died 3 days after presentation. So this patient, this toxidrome I'm showing you, sort of looks like a hypersensitivity reaction. So hopefully you're thinking about abacavir. Okay, abacavir causes a very severe hypersensitivity in certain susceptible patients that can actually present as death. Okay, it could be fatal. And the pathophysiology behind this is there's a HLA-B57 gene protein product that can be bound by abacavir. And normally that protein product is not immunogenic, but when abacavir binds to it, it causes some kind of a structural modification that basically shuts down whatever tolerance you built up in, I guess, your embryonic years, and you form cytotoxic T cells against that complex, and that can cause a very severe hypersensitivity reaction. So in general, before a person gets abacavir, which is an NRTI, you need to perform some kind of HLA-B57 testing. Okay. Now, drug of choice, so next case, drug of choice in the management of a diabetic presenting with very high fevers and severe sinus tenderness. So hopefully you're thinking of mucormycosis, okay, classically caused by like rhizopus species. You want to go ahead and give amphotericin B. It's the only drug that has like rescued some people. This can actually be pretty fatal. And remember, amphotericin B works by binding ergosterol. Okay, it's very nephrotoxic. But if you give the liposomal form, you could potentially reduce toxicity. And remember that you could also use, you could actually use amphotericin B to treat a cryptococcal meningitis. You typically add a 5-fluocytosine to that. Okay, next case. Afferent papillary defect in a patient with a recent history of hemoptysis with a chest x-ray showing a right upper lobe cavitary infiltrate, right? So this is clearly TB, okay? So how do you treat TB? You can treat it with the right regimen, right? So like rifampin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol. Ethambutol works by inhibiting an enzyme known as arabinosyl transferase that helps you make some substrate that's bound by mycolic acid as you synthesize the cell wall of fungi. Okay, so ethambutol is used to treat TB. Okay, it's associated with optic neuritis, which again can present as an afferent papillary defect. Okay, so don't forget, they could easily tie this in with the swinging flashlight test that you learned about in neurology. Okay, next case. Neonate in a developing country is unresponsive on presentation. He was rushed to the hospital by ambulance. A review of his chart reveals a medication error. This child was recently treated with a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor for some congenital infection. Okay, for some congenital infection, right? So hopefully you're thinking about Bactrim, okay, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. You generally do not want to give this to a neonate, okay, because it can cause kernicterus. And the mechanism behind that is TMPSMX can displace indirect bilirubin, okay, from albumin, and that indirect bilirubin can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause a lot of problems in the neonate, okay. And remember that trimethoprim, right, it's a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor. The SMX part, sulfamethoxazole, works by inhibiting a dihydroptherate synthesis. But basically, those two drugs work together to inhibit the synthesis of folate in bacteria. And remember that that's the drug of choice in the prophylaxis against pneumocystis jirovetsi in a HIV patient when the CD4 count plummets below 200. Next case, rising PCO2 in a patient being treated with amikacin for an aggressive Pseudomonas infection. An EMG reveals a reduced amplitude of contraction with phrenic nerve stimulation, right? So amikacin is clearly an aminoglycoside, right? And remember, your aminoglycosides, they basically work by inhibiting the 30S contribution to the P site, so the inhibitor initiation. I remember they are the only protein synthesis inhibitors that are generally bactericidal. Okay, so they cover Pseudomonas really well. But it so happens that these drugs also have the ability to bind to the presynaptic calcium channel that you find at synapses. Okay, so that can prevent the release of acetylcholine. So these drugs are actually associated with a neuromuscular blockade. Okay, another drug class that also has this side effect are your calcium channel blockers, your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, like verapamil and diltiazem. Okay, remember this is sort of similar to the pathophysiology behind the Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, which is classically associated with small cell lung cancers on exams. Okay, so last case. So hemoglobin of 4.5, platelet count of 15,000, and white count of 500 in a child with a history of somnolence and nuchal rigidity. CSF studies revealed very low levels of glucose, elevated protein levels, a preponderance of neutrophils, and gram-negative diplococci that ferment maltose and glucose. Okay, and then I add some addendum at the end about the adult presentation. Okay, so this patient basically has an aplastic anemia. Okay, you can imagine that they have Neisseria meningitidis meningitis. Okay, so remember your CSF studies in bacterial infections. So let's assume this person was in a developing country with very few resources, and they got chloramphenicol, because chloramphenicol is very good at crossing the blood-brain barrier. Remember, it works by inhibiting peptidyl transferase, so it's a 50S inhibitor. But it can cause aplastic anemia as a side effect. Okay. Another thing I would go ahead and say with regards to chloramphenicol toxicity, right, is that it can cause the gray baby syndrome, because it's metabolized by UDP glucuronosyl transferase, right? So you generally don't want to give chloramphenicol to a neonate, because they have, like, in general, they have very low levels of UDP-GT, okay? So they do not metabolize the drug, so they can get more toxicity from chloramphenicol, okay? In fact, one high-yield, I'll say probably the only time you'll see chloramphenicol given on an MBME exam is in the setting of rickettsia, rickettsial infection in a pregnant female, okay? Chloramphenicol is actually indicated for that. Now, one adult presentation that where they could give you a very unusual MBME question where a person has like chloramphenicol toxicity is with Krigler-Najar syndrome. Okay, remember, it can cause this is one of those GI disorders where you get an indirect hyperbilirubinemia because you have a UDP-GT deficiency. Okay, so it could present with they could easily give you a question. Person has a UDP-GT deficiency like Krigler-Najar syndrome, and they ask which of the following drugs is contraindicated. Okay, chloramphenicol will be one of those drugs. Okay, so just something to keep in mind. I know this took a little over 20 minutes. I spent some time greeting you guys at the beginning, and I guess talking about some other fluff. But I wish you all the best. If you spot any errors, or if you have any questions, just shoot me a message, okay, or make a comment in the podcast, and I'll try to answer them as quickly as possible. Have a wonderful day, and all the best to the fourth years with the match tomorrow. Thank you.